sister who came in here tonight was so fascinated by the look of these flowers, she had to come up and touch them to convince herself they were real. And if you're sitting back there, I can assure you they're real. That's a beauty that comes out, living beauty. It's not a beauty that's painted on. Now, that beauty that comes out, it always excels the beauty that's put on. A put-on beauty doesn't last very long. It'll be there at night and it's gone in the morning. That's the beauty the Lord gives them. Yes, these are real. They look real pretty. Tonight I want you to open up to chapter 18 of the book of Job. Chapter 18. You'll notice that it's quite a brief chapter. 21 verses in it. It's the record of a speech by Bildad. It's his second speech. And he's a man who prides himself in brevity. And not only does he pride himself in being brief in what he says, but he's very sarcastic about Job, who takes so long to say what he's got to say. He thinks that Job should be like himself and just say it just for a few words. Now let us read down through the chapter first, since it's a brief chapter. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, "How long will it be ere ye make an end of words?" Mark. "And afterwards we will speak. Wherefore are we counted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight? He teareth himself in his anger. Shall the earth be forsaken for thee? And shall the rock be removed out of his place? Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out. The spark of his fire shall not shine. The light shall be dark in his tabernacle, and his candle shall be put out with him. The steps of his strength shall be straightened, and his own counsel shall cast him down, for he is cast into a net by his own feet. He walketh upon a snare, the jinn shall take him by the heel, and the robber shall prevail against him. The snare is laid for him in the ground, a trap for him in the way. Terror shall make him afraid on every side, shall drive him to his feet. His strength shall be hunger bitten, and destruction shall be ready at his side, shall devour the strength of his skin. Even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. His confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle. It shall bring him to the king of terrors. It shall dwell in his tabernacle because it is none of his. Brimstone shall be scattered upon his habitation. His roots shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off. His remembrance shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street. He shall be driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world, shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor any remaining in his dwelling. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day, as they that went before were affrighted. Surely, such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God." What a speech. Put yourself again in the place of poor Job. Try to capture all that he's passed through and all that he's passing through. How would you have felt if someone made that speech to you? Now again, I want to stress this principle that much that this man says here is true. There's a lot of truth in what he's saying. But the application of it is entirely out of place. It's obvious that these things are said for Job's special benefit. He's addressing them to Job, and Job's supposed to take them and apply them to himself. Now, how would you have felt if here this man comes along who pretended to be your friend? Now, remember how the cycle has gone. Eliphaz, who seems to be the oldest, makes his speech, thinking, now that's enough, that should finish the whole inquiry. But he didn't. Job is able to answer him. And then Bildad stepped forward and he made his speech. It's much to say, now, that'll close the whole argument. But he didn't. Job was able to give an answer to him. And then the third member of the party, he steps forward and he makes his speech. Surely after three lawyers have all made their accusations and given their orations with high-sounding language, that should finish it. But no. Job comes back again and he seems to be fit to answer them all. But as I have indicated already, and I'll suggest it again, the difficulty in passing through this book is this. All the arguments appear to be on the human level. Neither the three men who are making those accusations against Job nor Job himself. They don't understand what's going on up there behind the scenes. That a challenge has been made and the devil has accepted the challenge and he's out to get this man of God. God's servant. And he's going to bring him down. And he said, I'll get him to the point where he'll curse God to his face. These three have come along and they're going by outward appearances. Now they've all had a turn. Job has answered the three of them. Eliphaz stands forward again and he makes his second speech. If he didn't accomplish his end in the first speech, he'll have it again. Second round. Job answers no. And this fellow here called Bildad the Shuhite, he steps forward. And it seems to me as I read down through this chapter, he's a sarcastic kind of a man. So sarcastic that he says to Job, how long will it be ere you make an end of words? That's what you accused us of. You accused us of just blowing a lot of words, a lot of wind without any matter. But it's you that's doing that. Each of us have spoken. Eliphaz has spoken again. And all you're doing is answering back again and throwing it back on us. You're just speaking a lot of words. When are you going to stop trying to justify yourself? Plain words in modern language, you would say, you know, when are you going to shut up? When are you going to keep silent and accept the verdict we've given you? We say you're guilty. There's somewhere behind the scenes, there's hidden sin. Now, it's you that's blowing the empty words. See how sarcastic he is. He's taking what Job has said, and he's throwing it back on himself. How long will it be ere you make an end of words? Mark, and afterwards, we will speak. In plain words, hello Job, you don't know what you're talking about. After all, see what we've quoted to you. We've got the majority on our side. That's obvious. Now, don't you see, this fellow is going down through the same line of argument as he went through already in his first speech. In fact, we've got to see this again and again. Those three seem to have combined in what they're going to do. They have made up their mind how they're going to get Job into a corner. They're the majority. And if it's three against one, how can he possibly continue to justify himself? A And he's saying to him, now look, it's just about time that you were listening to us. If there's three of us and there's only you, surely the wisdom we have is far superior to your wisdom. But according to your argument, Job, you think that all the wisdom is with you. You remember what he said when he answered them already. He said, oh, yes, you're the people, all right. You're the people. And when you die, wisdom will die with you. You've got it all. You see, Job himself was sarcastic with them. Now this man is standing around and he's throwing the same thing back on him. In plain words, no, it's you that thinks you have all the wisdom. So therefore he says it's about time that you were taking a rest and just drawing the period, drawing the mark and stopping and listen to us. Then he says, I'll go a little further. In your speech, you've looked upon us as being beasts. Wherefore are we counted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight? Plain words is saying, look, you're blaming us for coming along here and getting on you, and we're coming along here in opposition to you. That's what you're saying. The fact of the matter is, it's yourself. The anger is in your heart, and you're bringing it all on yourself. You're blaming it on us. Now, keep yourself in Job's place now. He's an innocent man, but he hasn't yet learned the lesson that God's teaching him. So he takes up from verse 4 and he says, he teareth himself in his anger. Plain words, Job, it's yourself. You're getting all worked up to this, and you're letting this anger get hold of you, and it's rending you. It's not us that's rending you. We're only telling you the truth, that's all. It's yourself that's doing it. You're rending yourself apart. Tearing yourself. Now, you know, you've got to admit with me, there are some folks who really do that. They do that. But you see, again, I'm saying, while this man speaks a lot of truth, the application of it on this occasion is wrong. He said, he teareth himself in his anger. He says, shall the earth be forsaken for thee? Now, Job, do you think that God's going to alter all the principles of creation just to suit you? After all, if God has put certain principles into operation, don't think for a moment that he's going to alter these for your sake. Now, these three men, as you remember, are claiming to have a knowledge of certain principles that operate in God's realm. And he's saying to him here, now look, shall the earth be forsaken for thee, and shall the rock be removed out of its place? A rock is a kind of settled thing, you see. You've heard it said, it's about as sure as the rock of Gibraltar. Solid. Do you think that that's going to be moved just for the sake of pleasing you? Don't you realize these principles are operating, and it's affecting you? Again, I remind you, they didn't know what was going on from behind the scenes. Now watch, he's saying now something here about the sure doom of the wicked. Between verses 4 and 7, he's showing how God acts with the wicked. Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out. The spark of his fire shall not shine. I want you to picture now that eastern sea, priding themselves in being hospitable to all who would come along. The night shades are falling, but here's this Arab in his tent, and he puts up a light. Now you know that when the darkness falls, you can see a small light from a great distance. Even the light of a match can be seen for a long distance. A little flash lamp You can see the long distance away with the dark night. And here this man, he puts a little light on his tent. Wherefore? To indicate to any traveler, there's a welcome here. There's hospitality here. Come along and share in it with us. But the wicked don't do that. The wicked don't put the light there. And he said, you know, the light of the wicked shall be put out. The spark of his fire shall not shine. He won't keep his fire burning at night. To welcome the stranger will go out. And the light in his tent will go out if he's a wicked man. Now you see the application he's making here, Job. The light of your house has gone out. The spark of your fire has gone out, which proves beyond the shadow of a doubt you're a wicked man. That's a principle that operates. And he's applying this to Job. He goes a little further. The light shall be dark in his tabernacle, and his candle shall be put up. The steps of his strength shall be straightened. Poor Job. He's sitting there and he hears all this applied to him. Now he goes a little further. When you come to verse 8, he's telling us this. For he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walketh upon a snare. In plain words, Job, you're a man that's been acting the hypocrite, and you've set a snare for others. You've been setting a trap for others, and you've fallen into the trap yourself. You've been caught in the snare. You've been caught in the trap. If you hadn't set the trap for other people, you would never have been caught in it yourself. Job must have been thinking now, this accusation, how is he going to answer this? The jinn shall take him by the heel, and the robbers shall prevail against him. The snare is laid for him in the ground, and a trap for him in the way. Terrors shall make him afraid on every side, and shall drive him to his feet. Plain words, that's exactly, Job, where you are. You're gripped with terror. First you're crying to men, then you're crying to God, and you don't know where you are. It's obvious to us, Job. You're a sinful, wicked man. You know, and I know, from reading the first two chapters and the remainder of this book, Job was not a wicked man. God says he's my son. Have you considered my servant, Job? But you see, these men were only coming to a conclusion by outward appearances. Job, you remember, in giving his answers, he said he had seen wicked men prospering. And he had seen righteous men suffering. Oh, this man said, that isn't true. That's not the conclusion we have reached, and that's not the conclusion of the majority. That's not how people see it. It's only wicked men who are put under judgment here. It's only wicked men who lose these things. God blesses the righteous, but he judges the wicked. And since all this has come upon you, you've been caught in the trap. You've been laid by the heel. Terrors have made you afraid. It's obvious, Job. You are that wicked person that God is chastising. He goes a little further. You see, this fellow is determined he's going to prove his point. When you come to verse 12, he says, speaking now of the wicked man still, his strength shall be hunger-bitten, and destruction shall be ready at his sight. He shall devour the strength of his skin. Even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. His confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle. They shall bring him to the king of terrors. Shall dwell in his tabernacle because it is none of his. Brimstone shall be scattered upon his habitation. Plain words, disease and death will be his portion. Job, if that's the conclusion we've reached, and that's the verdict of the majority of intelligent men, it's obvious you're that man. He doesn't need to say that. But that's what he's presented. Isn't it true, Job, that you have come there? Where's your home now? It's gone. Destroyed. You haven't got a home. You're out here sitting in the ashes. Where's your family? Gone. You're left alone to languish. It's obvious that the only thing that faces you now is death. And that's exactly what Job had been thinking when he was sitting there suffering from this awful disease. He thought it was terminal. Nobody had a cure for it. So therefore he was of the opinion now, all I've got to look for is death. That's what he's already been saying. It would be far better for me if I could just die and get rid of all this trouble. And this man is rubbing in the salt. That's exactly what's left for you. Disease and death is the portion of the wicked man. And that's all you have got to look forward to. But then, you remember Job said in one of his answers, he said, if a tree is cut down, there's hope for that tree. As long as its root is there, you cut down the tree, and that tree will sprout again. Now, there are a great number of trees that do that. One of the trees that will do that is the olive tree. In the Middle East today, there are olive trees that have been there for about 2,000 years. See them in the Garden of Gethsemane, the old olive trees. Old trees. If you cut them down, you'll find that branches will come up out of the root, a branch out of the root, and will come again and become trees. Cut down the trees, says Job, and water will cause it again to spring forth. There was not his argument. But watch now, this man takes up that argument against Job. And see what he says. Look at it in verse 16. Here he says, his roots shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off. See what Job, your argument was this. The branches may be cut down, but as long as the root is there, it can spring forth again and bring forth fresh branches. No, he said, but so far as you are concerned, not only have your branches been cut off, you remember he had 7 branches, but 10 branches, 7 sons and 3 daughters. 10 all branching out, but if you take 7 sons who have done with her others, cut off, the branches were cut off, but Job was still there. And he's saying there's a hope yet. No, says this man Bildad. Job, not only have your branches been taken away, but your roots shall be dried up beneath. And if the roots are dried up and dead, there's nothing else to be produced. Root and branch dried up. His remembrance shall perish from the earth. He shall have no name in the street. He'll neither have a son. And the word he for nephew is grandson. He'll neither have a son nor a grandson. You'll have none to come after you to carry on your name. You'll be forgotten. Gone. Your roots will be dried up. Branches shall be cut off. He shall be driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. He shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. You'll not suggest to me for a moment that that man's speech would bring any comfort to Job in the midst of his troubles. Again, I say, let us put ourselves right in this man's place. Facing those three men who at one time pretended to be our friends, and one after another they have lashed us, and lashed us again and again. We've been able to give an answer to them. They start the second round, and this is the second one in the second round. And now, with all the sarcasm he can muster, he's letting Job have it again, down the same line of argument. We have seen this. We know what the standards are. We know what the principles are. And it's obvious, Job, that you are being smitten now because you're a sinner. And there's some secret sin in your life, and God is judging you for it, and now you're going to be cut off. You haven't repented. You're not prepared to admit it. You're going to be cut off, and your name will be forgotten. Remember what God said about him? My servant Job, a pious man, an upright man, but that's not what his so-called friends are saying about him. But he's going to conclude this little speech by coming to the end of the day. Verse 20. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day, as they that went before were affrighted. Don't you see, Job, there was a time when people looked up to you. You were a wonderful man. Socially, you stood head and shoulders above all the others. You were the envy of your neighbors. Why, you were prospering. See the farm you had. See the servants you had. See all the livestock you had. And see that great family you had. And they were all prospering. And people looked up and they were almost afraid of you. But things have changed. No longer are people like that with you. Though that come after you now, they're going to be astonished. You'll be a laughing stock. They'll tell their children, did you ever hear the story of Job, that great rich man, that prosperous farmer? But God dealt with him. God brought it to light. God brought him down, and he's gone, and he's left nothing to honor his name. Surely, such are the dwellings of the wicked. You see how he's going to summarize this whole argument. Oh, I think of him, he'd point that index finger right at Job. You know, Job, you cannot confute our argument. And such are the dwellings of the wicked. And this is the place of him that knoweth not God. What a way to finish his second speech. Plain words, Job. All that we've said to you just proves that you're right there in the place of the wicked man. And as such, Job, you don't know God. You professed you did. You remember, Job, when you used to make sacrifices? You used to hold little religious services. Every time that your sons or daughters had a party, you had a religious service. Following that, you made sacrifices to God. Is that what you did? You didn't even know God. In plain words, Job, you're just a hypocrite. That's all. A wicked person. You're suffering for your sin. Now I wonder, what answer could Job give to such an accusation? One would almost feel that it's wrong to stop there. We should go right on and take his answer. But I'll leave you to read it out at home. Oh, chapter 19. Wonderful chapter. I believe it's one of the best known chapters in the whole book of Job, where he speaks of his Redeemer. Perhaps between now and next Wednesday night, you'll get time to read it out at home. See what you've come up with in your own mind as to how Job answered these vile accusations. Perhaps we'll bow together in prayer. We'll ask our brother Paul Smith if you'll dismiss us with a word of prayer. Will you do that, Paul?